Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, holding what is likely his final news conference before his retirement from government service that has spanned over half a century. He says he wants to be remembered for having given it all every day, leaving nothing on the field. And on COVID-19, he's urging Americans to get fully vaccinated to protect themselves and their loved ones. And looking back, he says he could not have imagined what he calls a three-year saga of suffering and death and a million Americans losing their lives. Just ahead, we'll hear from Dr. Fauci and talk with The Hill's healthcare reporter Nathaniel Wechsel. President Joe Biden extending the moratorium on student debt repayments as his proposal to forgive up to $20,000 in federal student loans is being challenged in court. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy in line to become House Speaker come January, traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border and saying to the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, either resign or we will investigate. He says every order, every action, and every failure to determine whether we can begin an impeachment inquiry. U.S. Court of Appeals hearing a challenge to the special master appointed to review documents taken during the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's home in Florida. We'll talk about that with a Bloomberg News reporter. And Sissy Marshall, widow of the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, has passed away. An announcement from the Supreme Court. Now to Dr. Anthony Fauci, White House Chief Medical Advisor and, since 1984, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. His final White House press briefing before his retirement from government service, that's spanned over 50 years. Today, Dr. Fauci pushing one last time for Americans to get the now available COVID-19 subvariant vaccine booster shot, as well as the annual flu shot.
So you have immunological data, and you have now clinical efficacy data. Everybody was asking the question, where's the clinical efficacy data? Now it has come out with the CDC, MMWR this morning. So we know it's safe. We know that it is effective. So my message and my final message, maybe the final message I give you from this podium, is that please, for your own safety, for that of your family, get your updated COVID-19 shot as soon as you're eligible to protect yourself, your family, and your community. I urge you to visit vaccines.gov to find the location where you can easily get an updated vaccine. And please, do it as soon as possible.
Dr. Fauci in the White House briefing room over the past couple of years during the COVID-19 pandemic and the government's response. He has become the face of that response, first under former President Trump and then under current President Biden. CDC's COVID-19 data tracker website, over the past 3 months, they find the average weekly new COVID-19 cases in the U.S., 280,000. Average COVID-19 deaths per week, 2,200. Dr. Fauci asked by a reporter what to him was the most difficult time during the pandemic.
You know, we've all lived through almost 3 years of the most horrendous outbreak that we've experienced as a society in well over 100 years. But there are certain things that stand out. I mean, I could probably write an essay on all the things that were difficult time. But one of the things, as a physician, whose goal in life is to care for patients and to prevent and treat illness and ameliorate suffering, is that I remember back in my days in medical school and when I was an intern and a resident, when a patient came in, whether or not the patient didn't like you, was angry with you, whether it was a rich person or a poor person, you treated everybody the same because you cared about them and you wanted everyone to walk out healthy. So when I see people in this country, because of the divisiveness in our country, of not getting vaccinated for reasons that have nothing to do with public health, but have to do because of divisiveness and ideological differences, as a physician, it pains me because I don't want to see anybody get infected. I don't want to see anybody hospitalized, and I don't want to see anybody die from COVID. Whether you're a far-right Republican or a far-left Democrat, doesn't make any difference to me. I look upon it the same way as I did in the emergency room in the middle of New York City when I was taking care of everybody that was coming in off the street. So that's the thing that troubles me most about this.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top U.S. infectious disease expert, today in the White House briefing room. Another reporter asking him, with his impending retirement from government service, how he'd like to be remembered.
This is your last appearance at the podium. You became a household name in large part because of your appearances here at the early stages of COVID. What do you want Americans to remember about your service in government?
Well, I think what I've accomplished in my 54 years at the NIH and my 38 years as the director of NIAID, although COVID is really, really very important, it is a fragment of the total 40 years that I've been doing it. So I'll let other people judge the value or not of my accomplishments. But what I would like people to remember about what I've done is that every day for all of those years, I've given it everything that I have, and I've never left anything on the field. So if they want to remember me, whether they judge rightly or wrongly what I've done, I gave it all I got for many decades.
More on Dr. Anthony Fauci's retirement and the continuing campaign against COVID-19. Joining us now on the phone, Nathaniel Wexel, healthcare reporter with The Hill. Thanks for being with us. Dr. Fauci leaving after being an advisor on infectious diseases to seven presidents, more than 50 years. What will he be remembered for?
I think a lot of it is he's going to be remembered for COVID and his response to the pandemic. And I think it really depends on who you are. A lot of it is going to be on the negative side from the Republicans who don't like that he stood up to Donald Trump. And then there's going to be a lot of the Democrats who like that he stood up to Trump. And I think that's probably going to be his legacy. People are just going to remember seeing Fauci up there on the podium talking science.
Well, he touched on this during the news conference that his advice and other scientific advice ended up being viewed as political. Why did that happen?
I think a lot of it is because of his role in the previous administration. When former President Trump was talking about the pandemic response and talking about things that were, not necessarily scientific, like, drinking bleach or something like that, and Fauci felt like he had to stand up for his job and stand up for scientists and say, this is not right. And I think a lot of people took that to be politics and a lot of people took that to be political. I think he says he didn't intend that to be. He just wanted to speak the truth. But, in this day and age, when everything is polarized, everything is political, science became political.
And one more question about Dr. Fauci and the retirement. The House of Representatives, soon to be a majority Republican, and they have planned some investigations. What can we expect?
Yeah, I think we can expect a lot into the origins of COVID and a lot of sort of where the virus came from and what role the administration, whether it's through Fauci, whether it's through previous people in the NIH, just sort of what grants they gave to who, what role they played in propping up or funding this lab in Wuhan, China. And I think Republicans are just going to want to hear a lot from Fauci, and whether it's from, whether it's his role in the Trump administration, whether it's his role in the current administration, whether it's his role, as we said about Wuhan, is just they're going to want to know everything about him.
We're talking with Nathaniel Wexel from The Hill. Today, the White House making an announcement on another effort to get people fully vaccinated. What's part of that?
The administration is going to spend a couple hundred million dollars in trying to boost some of these lagging vaccination rates. They want to make new publicity campaigns. They want to get pop-up booster clinics. They really, they're doing this push up ahead of the winter holidays towards the end of the year. They want to make sure that people get their shots before Christmas.
How has the effort gone so far to get people to get this new updated booster shot?
Yeah, so this new updated shot really it's not gone very well. There's only about 11% of the population over the age of 5 that's gotten an updated booster, and only about 30% of people over age 65. And those are the ones who are the most vulnerable and the ones who are most at risk. So, I think the administration realizes that the more needs to be done. The booster campaign has been pretty lackluster so far. People are just kind of tired of COVID. So they're trying to break through that, whether it's, vaccine campaigns, whether it's, as we said, just trying to trusted messengers. They're trying sort of everything that they can right now.
people tired of COVID-19, but as I guess the saying has now been, they've been saying this for a while, COVID's not tired of us. It's sticking around. What is the long-term outlook for how COVID is going to remain within the U.S. population going into the future?
Yeah, I mean, that was there were some questions about that with administration officials, and you know, a lot of them are saying it's hard to tell because this virus is so unpredictable. But you know, Ashish Jha, who is the current White House coronavirus response coordinator, he said he thinks there's probably going to be a need for an annual booster shot, but the death toll should be close to zero, he said, if everyone gets the booster now, everyone gets treated who needs treatment when they get infected. There are tools available as long as people make use of them. So, you know, the hope and the sense is unless there's some sort of curveball about the virus that, you know, science is prepared for it and there are tools available for people to make sure they don't die.
Nathaniel Wechsel is a healthcare reporter with The Hill. His stories can be found at thehill.com and on Twitter. He's at Nate Wechsel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And back to the White House briefing. Dr. Ashish Jha was there with some details about this latest campaign urging Americans to get the updated COVID-19 vaccine booster shot.
We've already had 35 million Americans have gotten their updated COVID vaccine, including 16 million seniors. And we are encouraged by steady and strong week-by-week numbers. We're seeing about 4 to 5 million Americans getting it every week. But we are working hard to reach even more Americans, especially older, more vulnerable Americans. So as I said, today we're launching a six-week sprint to help Americans get their updated shot by the end of the year. As part of this effort, with our limited resources that we have, we are making a series of announcements and a series of efforts to expand community-based COVID-19 vaccine efforts. So let me lay out some of them. We're announcing $350 million in funding to help community health centers meet people where they are, with facts, with vaccines, through proven methods like partnerships with faith-based groups and mobile vaccine clinics. We're announcing an additional $125 million to help local aging and disability networks to get older and more vulnerable and disabled Americans vaccinated. This will include efforts at senior centers across our great country. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, is going to be issuing guidance today, reminding nursing homes that they are required to educate their residents on the benefits of COVID-19 vaccines, and they are required to offer vaccines to residents. And nursing homes that don't do these very basic things will be referred for greater oversight and possibly face enforcement actions. We're doubling down on our trusted messengers work because we know that makes a difference. We're working with national and local organizations, state and public health departments, pharmacies. You're going to hear schools and colleges and universities announce that they're hosting clinics. All of this, we think, is going to make a difference. Also, what will make a difference is more paid media efforts by the Department of Health and Human Services, designed to reach tens of millions of Americans, for instance, that are watching the World Cup through television and through digital ads. Bottom line is that we're doing everything we can in the next 6 weeks to help families get their updated COVID shots by the end of the year, because it's the best protection for this winter.
Dr. Ashish Jha, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator today in the White House briefing room. A new survey from Gallup finds that 26% of adults who have jobs say they are very or moderately concerned about getting COVID-19 at their workplace. That's down 7 points from a similar survey in July. President Biden announcing today that while his plan for federal student loan forgiveness has been blocked by federal courts, it's being appealed, he will extend the pause on payment of federal student loans until the end of June 2023 or until his plan is okayed to be implemented, if that happens before then. His plan is to forgive $10,000 of federal student loans per borrower, up to $20,000 for those who use Pell Grants with income thresholds. To qualify, you have to be under $125,000 per year. President Biden tweeting this video today.
Folks, I want to give you an update on my student debt relief plan. As Americans continue to recover from the pandemic, My administration has been working to provide student debt relief to millions of working and middle-class families across the country. But Republican special interests and elected officials sued to deny this relief, even for their own constituents. But I'm completely confident my plan is legal. But right now, it's on hold because of these lawsuits. We're not going to back down, though, in our fight to give families breathing room. That's why the Department of Justice is asking the Supreme Court of the United States to rule on the case. But it isn't fair to ask tens of millions of borrowers eligible for relief to resume their student debt payments while the courts consider the lawsuit. For that reason, the Secretary of Education is extending the pause on student loan payments while we seek relief from the courts, but no later than June 30, 2023, which would give the Supreme Court an opportunity to hear the case in its current term. Payments will resume 60 days after the pause ends. I'm never going to apologize for helping working class and middle class families recover from the economic crisis created by the pandemic. And I'll continue working to make government work to deliver for all Americans, for all Americans. This is important.
President Joe Biden posting that video. The federal student loan repayments for more than 40 million Americans has been on pause since March 2020, the start of the coronavirus pandemic. From the Associated Press, American consumers with and nearly every industry will be affected if freight trains grind to a halt next month. One of the biggest rail unions rejected its deal Monday, joining three others that have failed to approve contracts over concerns about demanding schedules and the lack of paid sick time. That raises the risk of a strike, which could start as soon as December 5th. The railroads estimated that a rail strike would cost the economy $2 billion a day. And roughly half of all commuter rail systems rely on, at least in part, on tracks that are owned by freight railroads. And nearly all of Amtrak's long-distance trains run over the freight network. That reporting from Associated Press. White House asked today about how it is getting involved to potentially head this off. Here's a question to the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
There was almost a celebration in the Rose Garden 2 months ago with the president, with these labor leaders, with management. Is the president surprised to see that these, so many of these, obviously not all of them, but four out of the 12 of these unions have actually rejected a deal, which he tried to sell as a strong a deal for labor, for these workers?
So I want to be very clear here. The tentative agreement that we saw in September actually helped to prevent an immediate disruption to the economy. So that was important, that it was, we were able to prevent that. This administration, it worked to bring unions and rail companies together to reach that agreement, and it kept our rail system working and prevented a disruption, again, to our economy. So that was an important moment as well. Look, we're going to be steadfast in saying that all parties need to come together. They need to come together in a good faith, and we have to prevent a rail shutdown.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters. More from the Associated Press article. The stakes are so high for the economy that Congress is expected to intervene and impose contract terms on railroad workers. The last time U.S. railroads went on strike was in 1992. That strike lasted 2 days before Congress intervened. An extended rail shutdown has not happened for a century, partly because a law passed in 1926 that governs all rail negotiations, making it harder for workers to strike. Wall Street today, the Dow up 397, NASDAQ up 149, S&P up 53. Just 2 days before Thanksgiving, travel rush is on. AAA estimating almost 55 million Americans will go at least 50 miles from home this holiday. It's a 1.5% increase over 2021 travel and 98% of pre-pandemic levels. Vast majority of people will go by car, but 4.5 million will fly. And air travel is recovering to almost 100% of the 2019 levels before the COVID-19 pandemic. The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg tweeting this video.
So I'm in the air traffic control tower at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. It's one of the busiest airports in the country. And of course, we're going into one of the busiest travel weeks of the year with the Thanksgiving holiday. I've been talking to the workers here, air traffic controllers, and it is extraordinary to see what they do every day, along with the engineers, the inspection teams, the technicians, all of the people with FAA, and all of the airport workers and aviation workers who make it possible for millions of Americans to fly and get to where they're going safely. We owe them a huge debt of gratitude, and I am so thankful for the work that they do every day. Hope that everybody has an enjoyable and safe Thanksgiving holiday.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg with that tweeted video. Flying means going through airport security, staffed by officers from the TSA, Transportation Security Administration. TSA tweeting, is your family traveling for Thanksgiving? Check out our latest TSA Kids video for great holiday tips. Be sure to arrive at the airport early and feel free to say hello to our officers. Here's that video.
It's Thanksgiving. Let's share our top travel tips for this holiday season.
We love leftovers. Salad food is good to go. Creamy, liquid, or spreadable food items must be 3.4 ounces or less.
Your grandma's famous pie is okay to fly.
Make sure to give yourself plenty of time to get through security.
Let's give thanks to our officers who keep us safe while traveling.
Thank you for your support.
More information, go to tsa.gov.
A TSA video tweet on Thanksgiving travel. The Cape Cod Times in Massachusetts has a story that President Joe Biden will once again enjoy a Nantucket Thanksgiving. He and First Lady Jill Biden will travel to the island where they will celebrate the holiday with family. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said during a press briefing on Friday. On Thanksgiving Day, the Bidens will call members of the military to thank them for their service. They'll return to Washington, D.C. on Sunday. There's also this. The family has visited Nantucket each November, dating back to 1975. In 2020, President Biden observed the holiday at his Delaware home due to the pandemic. The tradition was then revived in 2021. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, who has been nominated for speaker by his party in the next Congress when Republicans will be in the majority, still to be determined whether he can get the 218 votes in the full House needed to get the speakership come January. Kevin McCarthy leading a delegation of House Republicans today to El Paso, Texas, along the U.S.-Mexico border to talk about immigration and border security. He says they were there to thank Homeland Security employees for their service during this Thanksgiving holiday week and also give a message to the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas.
Under Secretary Mayorkas, his deliberate suspensions of our laws have proved deadly. Fentanyl is now flowing in record amounts. Today, 300 Americans will be poisoned and die. Tomorrow, 300 more. It is the equivalent of an airline crashing each and every day in America. But again, he does nothing. If an airline crashed 3 days in a row, the entire nation would say, we have a real challenge. We have a crisis. We have a disaster. We have to do something about it. But he continues to lie to the American public. We have lost operational control of our southern border, empowering drug cartels and human traffickers. They have fired shots at our National Guard. They put AK-47s pointing at helicopters. They have burned and hung and raped the women and caught them on fire. And again, Secretary Mayorkas thinks the border is secure. He has blocked ICE and Border Patrol from enforcing our laws while vilifying them at the same time. Do you realize what that has done? In the last 10 days, 3 Border Patrol agents have committed suicide, a total of 14 this year, a number we have not seen in decades. He ended the Remain in Mexico policy and wants to end Title 42. His actions have produced the greatest wave of illegal immigration in recorded history. Our country may never recover from Secretary Mayorkas' dereliction of duty. This is why today I am calling on the Secretary to resign. He cannot and must not remain in that position. If Secretary Mayorkas does not resign, House Republicans will investigate every order, every action, and every failure will determine whether we can begin impeachment inquiry. If Secretary Mayorkas was in charge of any company, he would have been fired by now for the failures of what he has caused. The American public deserve more, deserve better, and expect more within their government. Enough is enough. We will do whatever it takes. This is my commitment to the men and women of the Border Patrol and to the citizens of the United States of America.
Congressman Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, currently the minority leader and nominated by his party to be speaker in the next Congress, the 118th Congress, which meets in January when Republicans will be in the majority. Today, Congressman McCarthy in El Paso, Texas, with a half dozen other House Republicans visiting the U.S.-Mexico border. On the use of impeachment, there is a House.gov page on impeachment, which says that outside of the 15 federal judges impeached by the House, three presidents have been impeached. That's Andrew Johnson, William Jefferson Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Donald J. Trump twice, and one cabinet secretary, William Belknap, in 1876, and also one U.S. Senator, William Blount of Tennessee, in 1797. C-SPAN's election page, cspan.org/election, shows Associated Press results for the House, Senate, and governor's races. And for the House, Republicans currently have 219 seats going into the next Congress, Democrats 212. That leaves just a couple of races not yet called. On Monday night, Republican incumbent David Valadao of California's 22nd congressional district was declared the winner in his race, beating Democrat Rudy Salas 52% to 48%. That makes David Valadao the second of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach former President Trump to win re-election. The other is Dan Newhouse of Florida. The other eight either retired or lost their re-election. The U.S. Supreme Court today okaying the release of Donald Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee, which is currently controlled by the Democrats. They made that request. The Supreme Court denying an emergency appeal to block a lower court's order that said the committee's request for the tax records is a legitimate part of the panel's legislative work. And the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals hearing a case today involving the seizure of documents, some marked classified, by the FBI during that search of former President Trump's home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. Here's a minute of the opening statement by the Justice Department, and then we're going to talk to a reporter about what happened today.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Sopan Joshi for the government. The district court entered an injunction preventing the government from using documents that were lawfully seized pursuant to a lawfully issued warrant in the course of its criminal investigation. And that extraordinary judicial intrusion into a core executive branch function should be reversed for three reasons. One, the district court should not have exercised its equitable jurisdiction over the case to entertain plaintiff's motion in the first place, as I think the state panel in this case recognized. Second, we don't think plaintiff has demonstrated and can't demonstrate the likelihood of success on the merits to warrant the extraordinary injunction that was entered. And third, at all events, plaintiff hasn't demonstrated and can't demonstrate any irreparable injury that would warrant the extraordinary injunction.
More on the U.S. Court of Appeals hearing today on the Justice Department's challenge to the appointment of a special master in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. Joining us is Zoe Tillman, who covers law and politics for Bloomberg News. Thank you for explaining this to us. What are the issues before the court?
Right. So the Justice Department generally is arguing to the 11th Circuit that the Florida District Judge, Judge Eileen Cannon, who appointed a special master to review the thousands of documents that were seized from Mar-a-Lago in August, and who also blocked prosecutors from using those materials in the criminal investigation in the meantime, basically that Judge Cannon lacked jurisdiction to do any of this in the first place. So setting aside the reason she gave for why, you know, it was a good idea to bring in a special master, the Justice Department has gone to the 11th Circuit to say this was not a situation where a court had the power to intervene in a criminal investigation before any indictment has been handed down. you know, criminal defendants have a variety of rights. Once they're charged, they can challenge the seizure of evidence. They can argue to suppress information. But courts generally are quite wary of stepping in to interfere with the executive branch before anything has happened. So that's what the Justice Department was arguing today.
How did the judges receive those arguments? Which way were they leaning? Could you tell from the questions?
The judges seem to be leaning quite in favor of the Justice Department, you know, especially Chief Judge Bill Pryor, who is no liberal judge. He's a conservative judge, quite a prominent one, a George W. Bush appointee, you know, who really pressed Trump's lawyer, Jim Trustee, about the lack of any precedent for a court intervening in this type of federal investigation before there's an indictment and without any kind of showing that the seizure itself was illegal or unconstitutional or that there was some kind of extraordinary circumstance that warranted a court stepping in at this stage. And, you know, at least one other judge on the panel, Judge Britt Grant, also seemed to join her colleague, Chief Judge Pryor, in questioning that. You know, I think it's fair to say that Trump's attorney faced a lot of skeptical questions in a way that the Justice Department attorney really did not. And in fact, many of the questions to him were about what exactly the court should do, assuming they agree with his position, which is can be a sign of where the court is headed.
The Attorney General Merrick Garland has now appointed a special counsel to take over this case and another case involving former President Trump. Does that affect what's happened today?
It shouldn't. The special counsel, Jack Smith, is not expected to make any major changes or if any changes at all to the team of prosecutors who have been working on this case for months, who have been litigating in court. And in fact, the Justice Department earlier this week filed a notice in the 11th Circuit, sort of formally alerting the court of Jack Smith's appointment and saying he'd reviewed the filings and approved of all of the arguments. So he's not expected to change the direction the Justice Department has taken here. I think the only the big question is if the Justice Department ultimately prevails and they get access once again to all of the thousands of documents that were seized from Mar-a-Lago, the question for Jack Smith is, what do they do with that? You know, is there evidence there that justifies charging former President Trump? But as far as where the case stands now, Jack Smith is not going to touch what the department has already done.
And the case that was argued today, do we know when there might be a ruling?
We don't know exactly when the court will rule, but the court did accept or grant the Justice Department's request to put it on what's known as an expedited track, which means they understand that time is of the essence. So they set it for arguments much faster than they normally would, and we would expect them to, in turn, rule much faster than they typically would.
Zoe Tillman is a reporter covering law and politics for Bloomberg News. Find her stories at Bloomberg.com, and on Twitter, it's at Zoe Tillman. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And C-SPAN covered this case, the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. You can find the oral argument, audio only, provided. It's at our website at cspan.org. Now to the war in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urging people and businesses in his country to limit their use of electricity, reflecting the massive damage that Russian missiles and drone strikes have caused on Ukrainian energy facilities as winter is setting in and the temperatures are falling. The head of a major power company in Ukraine says Ukraine has practically no intact thermal and hydropower plants left, and the scale of destruction is colossal, and that there would be blackouts until at least next April. The scheduled electricity shutdowns needed to prevent the collapse of the system. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that begins, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators urged the Biden administration Tuesday to reconsider its decision not to give Ukraine advanced drones, saying the technology could help Kyiv to hold its territory and gain battlefield momentum. In a November 22nd letter to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, 16 senators urged the administration to give Ukraine MQ-1C armed drones or Grey Eagles, which are medium altitude drones that can fly for more than 24 hours. The Pentagon declined Ukraine's request for the drones earlier this month. U.S. officials at the time worried that the technology aboard the drone could be stolen on the battlefield. That from the Wall Street Journal. Here's the Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh asked about this today.
You have now another group of bipartisan lawmakers asking the secretary to reconsider his decision, yeah, or parent's decision on the Great Eagle drones, the advanced drones for Ukraine. Do you have any responses to if it's still under consideration or what the rationale is for deciding not to give them that start?
I would say that nothing has been decided. We are always assessing and evaluating what we can send to Ukraine. But in terms of the Gray Eagles, no decision has been made. We have to examine what impact it would have on us and specifically for the Army, but nothing has been rolled out.
Do you know about the rationale, though, thus far for not providing them?
I mean, it's something that we're assessing. I wouldn't be able to go beyond that. I think in terms of just on the larger scope of rationale, we feel that what we've provided them so far has been they've been more than capable of using, and they've been more than capable of having instrumental gains on the battlefield. And so when and if there's a time that we provide the Gray Eagle, I'll certainly be reading that out. And I'm sure you'll be interested as well. Yeah.
The Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh taking reporters' questions at the Pentagon. Vice President Kamala Harris today in the Philippines visiting Palawan on the edge of the South China Sea, speaking against threats to local fishing communities from foreign ships overfishing in the region. Clear reference to the China fleet. China has made claims on the South China Sea that other countries like the Philippines say are theirs, or at least international. Vice President Harris, in a larger context, also speaking of international norms, sovereignty and territorial integrity and peaceful resolution of disputes and freedom of navigation and overflight. As China has been aggressive in staking its claim to the South China Sea, including building artificial islands, which have become military outposts. After her speech, Vice President Harris speaking with reporters, she also took a couple of questions about U.S. politics.
It is very important that we were here today to restate the United States' commitment to international rules and norms. This trip and this visit in particular has also been about demonstrating the strength and importance of our relationship with the Philippines, both as it relates to economic issues and also security issues. And as I've said previously, it is based on a foundation that has been established over many years and includes people-to-people ties and a shared commitment to the Indo-Pacific and to a free and open Indo-Pacific. Today has also been important to be here in Palawan. Palawan is a place where, as you've seen, generations of families and individuals have been invested in the fisheries that are here. They have demonstrated an incredible strength in terms of building community, building coalitions around the industries that are dependent on these fisheries to stand up and speak out about sustainable fishing and about the importance of speaking up against illegal activities as it relates to maritime law. So it has been important for us as the United States to demonstrate our commitment to the Philippines as a whole, but understanding also the nuances and complexities that the people of the Philippines face when it comes to not only what we need to do to ensure security and prosperity for the region, but also what we must do to address the climate crisis, be smart about that, highlight examples and models of how we can empower communities, and also speak about the importance of recognizing where this island in particular exists in the context of the South China Sea. So it has been a good trip for that reason.
Jenny.
Madam Vice President, would you support the new House Speaker, U.S. House Speaker visiting Taiwan?
Oh, I'm not going to speak to that. I think that, first of all, I don't think that we have actually made a decision yet about who this is, the House Speaker, or did that happen while I've been here?
Madam Vice President, a little bit off topic. So former President Trump, while we were about to come here, announced that he would be running again for the presidency. I wonder if you have a response to that announcement and whether or not you and President Biden on the ticket will beat him.
Well, as the president said, he intends to run, and if he does, I will be running with him, and I have no doubt about the strength of the work that we have done over these past 2 years. We have delivered unprecedented a relief for the American people through the height of the pandemic. We have passed an infrastructure law that many have talked about, but we actually did it. We just recently, with the Inflation Reduction Act, did a number of things, including bringing down the cost of health care, not to mention a $370 billion in the climate crisis, which is one of the reasons that I am here in the Philippines, because the climate crisis is an issue that requires leadership around the globe, and in particular, I would say, America's leadership.
But do you think a President Trump, former President Trump candidacy is good for the country, good for America?
I am thinking about right now what we need to do in the Indo-Pacific. Thank you for the question.
Vice President Kamala Harris with reporters in the Philippines. She and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff returning to the U.S. after a trip that also included a stop in Thailand for the APEC Economic Summit. The Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Qatar for both the World Cup soccer or football tournament to cheer on Team USA and also speak with the top Qatari officials about U.S. relations with that country. At a joint news conference today with the Qatari foreign minister, Secretary Blinken asked about a decision by the governing body of the World Cup of international soccer, known as FIFA, that decision to prohibit players from wearing armbands that support inclusion and diversity. An Associated Press article says that Qatar, the energy-rich Middle East nation, has been criticized ahead of the tournament over its treatment of migrant laborers and criminalizing gay and lesbian sex. Here's Secretary Blinken.
When it comes to the armband question, look, as I said earlier, one of the most powerful things about football, about soccer, is its potential to bring the world together, quite literally, as it's together here in Qatar, but also figuratively, in terms of just bringing human beings together and rediscovering everything that they have in common, and how that really does fundamentally outweigh the differences that we deal with every day. That's the power of sport. That's the power of what we see going on. And the message that we heard from the Emir is usually important, that all are welcome. And of course, it's important to make that meaningful, to put that into practice. It's always concerning from my perspective when we see any restrictions on freedom of expression. It's especially so when the expression is for diversity and for inclusion. And in my judgment, at least, no one on a football pitch should be forced to choose between supporting these values and playing for their team.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Doha, Qatar, a joint news conference with the Qatari foreign minister. More from the AP article. Secretary Blinken's visit comes as part of a strategic dialogue with Qatar, which also hosts some 8,000 American troops at its massive air base that serves as the forward headquarters of the U.S. military's Central Command. The U.S. Supreme Court announcing that Cecilia Sissy Suyette Marshall, the widow of the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, died this morning with her family by her side in Falls Church, Virginia. She was 94 years old. Chief Justice John Roberts, with this statement, Sissy Marshall was a vibrant and engaged member of the court family. She was often in the spouse's box for oral arguments at Supreme Court Historical Society events and rarely missed an investiture, memorial service, spouse's lunch, or other court occasion. She was warm and gracious and caring. You wanted to sit next to her at any event. She had an easy sense of humor that could be, in an appropriate setting, of course, a bit saucy. She was special, and all of us at the court will miss her greatly. That statement from the Chief Justice John Roberts. Back in 2014, the NAACP gave Sissy Marshall an award at an event on the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. That's the Supreme Court case that was argued by then-attorney Thurgood Marshall that led to the nationwide school desegregation policy. Here is Sissy Marshall, 2014.
If Thurgood were here today, I think he would encourage us to keep up the good fight, using the same words that he spoke on July 4th, 1992, when he accepted the Liberty Medal. He said, and I quote, "The battle for racial and economic justice is not yet won. Indeed, it has barely begun. The legal system can force open doors and sometimes even knock down walls, but it cannot build bridges. That job belongs to you and me. The country can't do it. Afro and white, rich and poor, educated and illiterate, our fates are bound together. We can run from each other, but we cannot escape each other. We will only attain freedom if we learn to appreciate what is different and muster the courage to discover what is fundamentally the same. America's diversity offers so much richness and opportunity. Take a chance, won't you? Knock down the fences that divide us. Tear apart the walls that imprison you. Reach out for freedom. Freedom lies just on the other side. We shall have liberty for all. Thank you.
Sissy Marshall in 2014 from C-SPAN's Video Library. It was an NAACP event on the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court case. The court announcing today that Sissy Marshall has died at the age of 94. The court releasing a statement from Justice Elena Kagan, who clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall, saying every clerk to Justice Marshall received a sort of bonus, the steadfast friendship and support of his wife, Sissy. She was a marvelous woman, and we all loved and admired her. The community of TM clerks will today feel a great loss. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more of Washington's top stories sent to your inbox every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.